I'm Richard Lannan, Ryan's with Canon, and this is the Glazing Insider Industry Podcast. This episode is brought to you by Nozzle. The Nozzle team captures photos, videos and drone footage from locations across the UK to create content for your social media and case studies for your website. To find out more about Nozzle's pay-as-you-go and monthly packages, visit nozzle.media. Welcome to the podcast dedicated to the people of the glazing industry. In this episode, I talk with Mark Reed, who is the MD of Wizzle. In this conversation, Mark talked us through his fenestration journey, all the way from how it started to the position he's in today. So, without further ado, let's get started. Mark, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Richard. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you for coming on. How did you get into the fenestration world?
Well, it's been a sort of long journey, really. I started off my career outside of the window fenestration industry. In fact, I didn't really have a career as such. I left school not really knowing what I wanted to do, but I had an interest in drama. So I did A levels, and at the end of that, I got a place at a college of further education in Exmouth in Devon.
Right.
So the plan was to finish school, and then go to Exmouth in the autumn to start the course. But my father had a printing business, a small printing business, that he said, you know, do you want to come and earn some money over the summer? So I said, okay. So I went to work for my father. It was an interesting business in that it was based in Hackney in East London. I was living with my parents near Enfield, sort of Cheshunt Way. So every day we'd go down there. My father was the floor sweeper there, and when the owners retired, he got given 50% of the business. Would you believe?
Wow!
Another lady who worked there got the other 50%. So he literally sort of fell into this. It was quite fortunate. So he gave me some work, and it was an interesting place to work. It's always difficult when you work with family, which is something I'm sure is shared amongst many people who work with their family. It was quite strained at times. It was in Hackney when Hackney was Hackney, if that makes sense. There was no yuppies around at the time. No very expensive apartments. It was a very rundown place. I spent 4 years there, 4.5 years running machinery and working in a warehouse, et cetera, et cetera. And I didn't go to college, clearly, because once I got some cash in my pocket, I thought, well, I don't really want to be a student with no money. So I didn't go. I didn't take up my place, and I worked there for 4 years. And I learned lots of things about work, the workplace. It was I got married. And I moved out of Enfield, and I moved up to a place called Royston, which is up near Cambridge. And so for most of that time, I commuted from Royston to Hackney every day. So it's around a trip of 3 to 4 hours driving. It's quite tiring, especially in the winter time. Yeah. And I had all sorts of experiences. This is back in the days, people used to have their wages paid in brown envelopes, and somebody used to go around the bank every week and collect the wages. It was always the same day, always the same time. One day I was out delivering some stuff in the van, and I came back into our unit. It's a very old Victorian building, and there's a stairwell there because there's a business up top. And there was a bloke with a double barrel shotgun, which he stuck up my nostrils, which is interesting. That was quite an interesting experience. Cup of tea, a couple of sugars in there, and 20 minutes later I was back working, as people did in those
sugar
days.
Sugar for the shock.
Yeah.
I still use that now on my kids.
Yeah, absolutely. But unfortunately, my father had a stroke at the age of about 54, so he survived to 81, actually.
And
he was quite happy in his new state, which was not to worry about anything. So he sort of logged off, if you like, of responsibility, passed it to my mother instead. which is not so great for her. But, unfortunately, I found myself in a situation whereby I wasn't particularly welcome. I didn't feel particularly welcome there, and I had no real sort of career pathway at all. And I was still operating machinery in the same way as I was when I first went there. You know, back in the school holidays before I joined up full time. So I decided I needed to get out of the business. Had a mortgage, so it was quite a sort of scary sort of time. And I decided I was going to start selling double glazing.
Right.
So that was my first interaction with the industry. If I'm honest, I went for double glazing because if you try to find a job that a sales job, which was what I was really after, you needed to have experience for most salaried positions, and I had no experience of sales at all. And I answered an advert for a company called Storm Seal, which is going back a long time ago. They're based up in Manchester, I believe, Bury, somewhere around there. And I got accepted for a position, which I don't think was a great achievement, really, in itself, because I think they'd taken on anyone, really, but give it a go.
Yeah.
So I did a week's training with them. It's residential training. I think it's a week or 2 weeks. It seemed like a long time. It was up in the Northwest. And the training, to be fair, was exceptionally good. They taught me about the industry and how to sell double glazing. Back in the 80s, which this would have been around 86, 87, I mean, the sales techniques were fairly basic and perhaps not the most ethically sound techniques, but nonetheless, it taught me how. It taught me about the sales process and about the window industry and home improvements generally. So I did that for 3 months, and it's commission only. I was living in Royston. I was based in Stevenage, which was, you know, by comparisons to Hackney, only a 40-minute drive away. So that was quite convenient. But of course, yeah, it's unsociable hours, evenings and weekends and whatever. But so that's all part of the job. The downside was that I did struggle to. I don't think I class myself as being overly successful in that I was there for 3 months and I managed to sell one residential back door to an elderly couple, and to which I earned the princely sum of 90 quid. And I, it was, yeah, my meager savings are running out. This is back in the day of interest rates of 15% on mortgages.
Black Wednesday.
Absolutely. So it was getting a bit hairy. I had a bit of a false dawn in that I managed to sell a full house of windows, and it was a decent amount. It was a five figure sum. It was a lot of money though in those days. And it was on finance too, so you know, everyone was really happy. And I went back, you know, after the sale, and you know, I had that sort of amazing sort of, you know, moment where you feel on top of the world. And then the next day I went into the office. I was called in by the manager, and he told me that they'd failed finance because they had 11 CCJs against them. So I had that sort of, because the commission from that would have, you know, that would have bought me some time to carry on doing what I was doing. But it was a case, I think that was the final nail in the coffin, and I had to sort of cut my losses. So I exited the window industry after 3 or 4 months, and then I went to, because I had some experience now anyway, so at least when I spoke to, you know, the next potential employer, I could at least say I'd had some sales training, I'd had some sales experience, albeit not particularly successful. You wouldn't necessarily share that with your, you know, prospective employer. And I was fortunate enough that the headquarters of a company called Unifix was in Royston. Unifix, those who don't know, was part of Dom Holdings, which was a company that was established in probably about 1970s, and it was the first company that sort of sold fixings, if you like, to the trade. They had had a manufacturing facility in Saffron Walden, injection moulding, so they were famous for raw plugs and cable clips, so not really necessary for the window industry, but they had some well-known products. So I got a job with Unifix, and that was great. Hometown, company car, a salary, and I could start, you know, earning some earning some money to sort of try and bridge the gap between my earnings and what the mortgage was. And that was an interesting time. I was with Unifix about 18 months. Like any big company, they were bought out a couple of times in that period, and the service levels went from sort of being okay to being quite poor as they restructured. And I decided that perhaps a move was the best thing to do, because I was going to see customers and saying, you know, on a monthly basis, saying, right, okay, so what can I get you this month? And they're saying, well, we've not had the order from last month yet, we've not had the delivery, which is, yeah, you know, you've got to take these things on the chin. But after maybe 3 months of that, you start thinking, you know, nothing's getting better. I'm not really making much progress. I'm letting my customers down more than anything else. So one of my customers I called on, who was a double glazing company in sort of Essex, North Essex, we got on well. He offered me a job working for him. It was a family company, very nice business, nice people. They were distributors for used coastal windows. The product was good. The particular guy I worked for was exceptionally decent chap who was very good at sales. In fact, he showed me a completely different way of sales, because he was very knowledgeable, very calm. He's very trustworthy, and for good reason. He was a trustworthy guy. So his business came from, you know, from referrals and recommendations, yeah, and so on and so forth. So it's quite a difference to that role, if you like, with that window company, compared to the first experience I had, which is a bit more your traditional harder sale. And I worked with them promoting windows to the building trade locally. And I was there again about 18 months or so. I think my biggest problem was that I feel that, despite not knowing what I wanted to do myself at school. So if you asked me at school, like the careers advisor, what do you want to do? I couldn't have told you. But I think I had the sort of yearning probably to be my own boss. Yeah. Have my own business. Don't ask me why. It might have been because my father had his own business, but you'd think, having seen the stress and the, yeah, worry and all the rest of it, that would put you off. But for some reason, it hadn't. And I think I still possessed that desire. So having had a stable period of working, like 3 years or so, I decided that I'd start my own business in the fixings arena. So that's how it started off, where it was fixing. So I left the window company on good terms, and I started the fixings company. So this is almost going back to the Unifix type of model. And I started off in a bedroom in my house, and I made a brave decision and took a guy on as a salesperson, lived in Royston, ex Unifix, and we did okay, as in I could pay his wages. We didn't have any extra overheads because we were working out of my house. I stopped a few boxes of screws in the garage. You know, it was pretty low key, but I could pay his wages. That's probably the main thing. I couldn't pay my own wages, so I had to go cab driving in the evenings. I did a milk round for a short period of time.
Wow.
I was sort of working sort of 16-hour days and still not earning enough to pay the mortgage, but at least I felt I was doing something that I had an interest in, as in like building a business. So that had a few curveballs in store, in that the first guy who worked for me, by the way, one of the taxi drivers said to me, one of my taxi customers said to me one Friday night when I was driving him home, I said, look, really excited, so I've taken on my first employee today. And he looked at me in the mirror and said to me, that's when your problems all start, mate. Because he was an employer. And I just thought, well, yeah, whatever, you know, there you go. So that was interesting. And lo and behold, 3 months later, my first ever employee ended up having an affair with my wife. And they, so I had to get out of the, I had to move out of the house and move into my first commercial premises, which was a converted pigsty, only just converted, as in not recently, it's only just,
yeah,
not a pigsty, if you see what I mean. So that was interesting. So I got thrust into sort of commercial premises, the first one, and moved out and lost an employee at the same time. So I was sort of back to myself again. Another guy contacted me, who was sort of in the same sort of group of people, who was an ex Unifix guy. He came along, we had a chat, I took him on, and interesting enough, his name is Neil Blanchflower, and he's still with the business today, would you believe? So it's sort of 35 years or so on.
Wow.
So, you know, it's not all your problems start when you employ people, but there's obviously, it's challenging, it throws new challenges at you, particularly when you're younger and less experienced or trained in staffing matters. So that was how the business started. So eventually managed to get some momentum. We did lots of business within the emerging satellite and cable TV market.
Right.
So we worked hard. We developed a range of products to be to mirror that particular market. We gained the business of Sky TV in 89, 91.
Wow.
Kept their business for 15 years. Yeah, it's surprising, really, because we're only a small business, but, you know, we had aspirations and we behaved like we were a bigger business, really. We got their business and we actually managed to build quite a sizable market share in that particular market. So it's quite a big market, but at the same time, it's dominated by, you know, a smallish number of players. But we were into the satellite industry, aerial installers. And then obviously as cable TV came on, it was a bit later than satellite. We got into the cable television companies. Originally with the cable TV companies, there was around 50 or 60 companies. So there was like an Andover Cable Vision, there was a Cambridge cable television. There was all Oxford cables. There's all these tiny cable TV networks. And what happened was, over a period of time, they amalgamated, they got bought out and merged, and you ended up with two companies, basically, which one of them's Virgin Media.
Right.
And I can't even remember what the other one is now, to be honest with you. But it ended up being like, if you weren't in with those particular companies, you had nothing. You know, that market sort of disintegrated. But the satellite side of things continued on for some time, and that went right away through up to about 2012. And that was when the digital switchover happened. So again, if people remember when you were told that your aerial wouldn't work after the analog signal was turned off, that was huge, because, you know, think of the number of aerials were in the UK that were being swapped over. But it wasn't just the aerials; it was the connectors, the cables. So all the ancillary products were swapped over at the same time. So it's an incredibly busy period of time. When the last one got switched off, which was Crystal Palace, at the back end of 2011, the phones just stopped ringing. It just died a death. So that whole industry really was boosted by the digital switchover. And it still continues today, and we still have customers in that particular industry. But being a technological industry, you know, there can be a change, and that can literally change the face of that whole market almost overnight. So there was always that risk that something would happen, and you know, it's great business today, and, you know, not great business the following week. So if I wind you back from 2012, we moved five times by the time we got to the year 2000, and we thanks again to my training probably with Storm Seal, the formal sales training. We started recruiting our own bigger sales team. We had 10 sales team members we recruited. So we ran our own recruitment campaign and we trained people in a residential, in a centre, sort of 5-6 miles away. And we started the whole sales team. And we'd moved to new premises. We had 30,000 square foot premises.
That's big.
It's decent size. Yeah. We had a sales office, and Neil was a sales manager. And we had to make a decision, really, in the early 2000s, in that we were supplying into the satellite industry, supplying into the cable TV market. But it's fairly clear at some point that the legs would run out on those. So went back to the original days of where I'd been involved in. It all came back to the window trade. I liked the window trade. I understood the window trade from the sales side of things. And I learned more about the business when I was working for the company in Essex too, because I was more involved in the day-to-day running of the business. we looked at the various market opportunities for us, and we decided that that the window trade perhaps should be our replacement market. So, you know, as one market ran down, we would be working to build our market share in the other, and that's what we set about doing. And that was the part of the journey really that led us to where we are today, which is, you know, probably one of the larger independent, fully independent family businesses in the sealants and consumables side of the window trade.
Wow, that is quite a journey. And it's unexpected, because when you said you started in double glazing, I thought you were going to go straight from there to where you are. And I know it doesn't tally with dates and things, but that was just the logic. So it's interesting that you actually found another route, another industry, and you still came back to fenestration.
Yes. I think the thing is, I like the industry. So even back in the day when I was at Stormsill, I could understand the value of what double glazing was trying to achieve. It's a genuine improvement on people's houses. I mean, particularly at my time when I joined, the double glazing was either wooden frames that were coming out, but more often than not, it was also the old aluminium, you know, with subframes. Yeah. And it looked horrible, really horrible. And when people had their, you know, their shiny UPVC windows, I mean, people were really happy with the work. The house looked modern, you know, rather than a dated 1970s sort of look. So there was some real genuine pleasure in being involved in that process. And at the second company I was involved in, it was a nice family business. Doesn't have to be a family business, but it was, and it was friendly, and, you know, the fitters were all were chummy, pally. Customers were, on the whole, once you got the business, they were engaged in the process, and everyone had a good outcome ultimately, normally, you know, with a few odd issues.
Yeah, you do get the odd one, yeah.
But yeah, it was an exciting business to be in. There was obviously back in the 80s, you know, you just had to look down the high street, and there were so many places in residential areas, there was so many properties, you know, that were either didn't have double glazing, or had very old, you know, aluminium sort of type, the original aluminium type of double glazing, that you could see there's potential to be able to really do an awful lot of work. So there was a big upside, you know, at the start. Whereas now it's a more mature industry. However, the key dynamic is still there, and the fact that, you know, it is a home improvement. You are doing something that is beneficial to the homeowner. You know? And we've only got to look at the COVID period. And since then, just to see how many people have bought new windows, doors, conservatories, and so on and so forth.
So, when you started, was the name Wizzle? Where did that come from?
Well, originally the business was called UK Fixings, and that was back in 1988 as a sole trader. That changed to UK Fixings Southern in brackets Limited in 1992, I believe. And, you know, if I'm honest, it's just a crap name, if I can say that.
I wouldn't class it as a crap name, though.
The trouble with it is that it was fine when we was doing fixings, and that was the main part of the business. But of course, you know, as you progress forwards with where your aspirations are market wise. It doesn't fit so well. So the other problem is there's lots of UK something, and there are the sort of UK fasteners and so on and so forth. So
yeah, I see. So, yeah,
you know, it was a bit generic, really, in many respects. Especially, it didn't really reflect what we were doing at the time. Because you think about it, we were really only very general in terms of the markets and products we supplied at the beginning. It was quite early on we specialised.
Yeah.
So really that name was just for the start. It didn't really reflect what we were doing. So we in 2010, we changed the name, and we wanted something that reflected the way the market had sort of changed from the customer, if you like, being relatively, ignorant's the wrong word, but ill-informed in that you had price lists and catalogues. So that's what you had in the early days. So, you know, you'd have a wad of information for people, but there wouldn't be pricing on there because obviously price is more dynamic compared to printing of catalogues. That was like an annual thing. And people generally speaking, as times have moved on from that period of time to the internet era, if you like, are wanting more and more information, you know, immediate at their fingertips. That's the way consumers are. You know, faster, better, we need to reflect that. So one day I was cycling in France actually, and I was trying to think of a new name for the business, and I thought, well, people just want to whistle and it turns up, you know, it's a whistle it. So I just came up with whistle, and that was, you know, a bit out of the blue, really, a bit of blue sky thinking. And I took it back to the team and said, what do you think to this? Few funny comments. It wasn't all positive, but at the same time, it was, as far as I was concerned, it was a real step change from UK Fixing Southern Limited. So some people didn't like it, customers wise. I didn't realise that in like Leeds area, it's a sort of slang for going to the toilet outside.
I'll go for a whistle. Yeah.
But you can't win them all.
No.
So, you know, and we still were plenty of people in Leeds and around there, and no one chuckles every time we mention what our name is, or, you know, they called us up. So we've got away with that.
Yeah.
And it's easy from a marketing perspective too, because it's a bit more snappy and memorable. So we're one of the first ones to get out the sort of izzle bit, you know. Now we're everyone's got names that have, you know, got a similar sort of sounding to it, sounding end. But yeah, so we it was good. It was good time. In 2010, we had a rebrand, and we went from there.
So you mentioned cycling in France. So you must be a cyclist.
Mm. I love cycling because I think ever since a kid, it's just a way of getting away from your parents, probably, and you know, escaping the home, because you can get on a bike and, you know, within 10 minutes you can be far away, or at least as it feels as a 14-year-old or a 13-year-old. And I think that sort of sense of freedom always carried itself with me. So I'm 56 now, nearly 57 later in the month, and I still think that if it wasn't for cycling regularly, you know, I wouldn't be as fit as I am, you know, relatively fit for my age. And I put most of that down to cycling, to be fair, because I can't run anymore because my knees have had it. And if it wasn't for cycling, then I'm not sure what else I'd do to keep myself physically fit. So it just keeps the weight off a little bit. And I like to cycle with my kids too. My son, Dave, is a good cyclist. We go out most Sundays and we do a couple of hours, and we have a good laugh.
I like that. Yeah, yeah. I like cycling as well. And it's cycling as a hobby is two parts, isn't it? Because you've got the gear and the bikes, and then you've got the actual going out. So how many bikes do you have?
In total, I think I've got about 16 bikes, from time trial bikes. I've got a track bike. I've got a tandem. I've got a three-wheel bike where I managed to break my leg. I still managed to cycle one-legged for a period of time in a tricycle, which is the hardest thing I've ever ridden in my life, because they tend to want to tip over all the time. Wasn't expecting that. And so I've got loads and loads of bikes. Every time I buy a new one, which is not very often, I never get rid of the old one or the old ones.
So right.
You just end up this growing collection of bikes.
I see. Yeah, some people I'll sell that one. I will sell it. I'll sell it, and then I suppose it's,
yeah, yeah. I find it's not so much like cars, where you tend to part exchange one for another, because the value is relatively lower. You can justify, you know, keeping an old bike, or at least you can try to. Yeah,
can. And bike prices now. I mean, I know a chap. He literally treats it like car finance on his bike, because he's spending thousands, and he just literally every 3 years he replaces his bike and carries on the payments. And it's
people pay more than 10,000 quid for a
easily,
bike.
Easily, yeah. Staggering, isn't it? Don't get me wrong. If I could afford a bike like that, I don't know if I'd want to take it out, for fear of, we've all fallen off, you know. Damaging carbon fibre is not for the faint-hearted.
No, and my son's bike, he crashed it. It was carbon fibre frame, and I had to find a specialist to repair that. And again, they'll only repair certain things. They won't repair everything, because, you know, carbon fibre is designed to work in a certain way and has to be structurally sound to do that. So they won't touch it. But he's fortunate they did.
Oh, right.
It was only a couple of hundred quid, which actually was pretty good for
them. Yeah, considering the replacement frame would have been...
A lot of people are going back to steel frames, to be fair.
I noticed they're making a comeback, aren't they? Yeah. And I looked at it. I've got a carbon, but it's a cheap... They've got different grades, haven't they? So it's like it's like entry level. But from a weight point of view, it does make a good, a massive difference. And then steel's coming in now, and they're doing both. So it used to be a lot of people were mountain biking. Again, they were bringing in the carbon fiber. It just didn't make sense. So I was always stick with the aluminium, and it was getting lighter anyway, and the components are getting lighter. So
absolutely. I've just got a standard aluminium road bike. To be fair, I could save 5 kilos by riding a. Having the new carbon frame bike, but I think the best way of doing it probably is taking 5 kilos off me if I want to get the combo down.
You know, everyone says that. You've got that. It's the amount of time you see these new people to cycling, and they've spent £10,000 on the bike to get it lighter. And you say, in a few months' time, after you've been cycling, those kilos will be gone. Interesting. So, with Wizzle, is that when you sort of took everything online, or was it always the case, or what sort of how has it developed over the years?
That's a good question. How's it developed? Well, it's developed really. We still have a voice team. We have a team of people, account managers, and that's great because some people just want to pick the phone up and literally sometimes just shout an order down the phone and they'll say it's so and so, it's Joe from X, and they could be off the phone within a minute or two. It's really useful. We've still got people who can take orders over the phone. We've still got a fax machine. Effectively, we still get orders by fax, which is quite interesting.
That's definitely fenestration.
We get WhatsApp orders, all sorts of things. So basically what we've text orders. So we've had to open up the channels that we offer to customers. So and to be fair, you know, online is one of them, but it's not the only one. And some people, and I probably includes myself, late at night, maybe early in the morning, I just want to go and order something, without having to necessarily speak to someone. Not because I don't want to speak to people. It's just the fact it just fits in with my particular schedule.
Exactly.
I just want to know it's on order. I'm going to get the goods, and that's the ethos that we have. So whether you phone up or whether you place an order online yourself, it doesn't really matter. It gets treated the same way. It all ends up in the same software system, which then goes to the fulfillment center, which is then fulfilled. So yeah, that has changed, and of course, as I was saying earlier, the people's expectations have changed dramatically. You need to have all the information in one place, so people can literally just click on a button, click on a page, and find out what they need. People don't want to phone up and ask, "What about the so and so? And what about this? What about the other?" Some people will do, but generally speaking, you want to have all the information, available for people so they can access it 24/7.
The best salesperson you ever had, a website.
Yeah, absolutely. It's horses for courses. So some people want that contact, and they wouldn't consider you to be a good supplier if they can't phone you when they want to phone you within reason. Other people won't touch you with a barge pole if you can't give them their online needs, be completely autonomous. We don't have that any sort of contact at all, other than the fact that we provide them with what they need, and we deliver. And they pay their bill, and that's equally, mutually beneficial. Mm. But that has changed. People's expectations obviously have changed, and people expect more these days, generally speaking. They expect more of what they want and to be tailor-made. So, it's an interesting challenge because you have to always keep considering how you can provide that to changing demographic as well.
Yeah.
Because different generations have different ways of doing business and different preferences, and so there's sometimes an older business that's been going for 34 years, whatever it is, you have to keep yourself on your toes, because many businesses have been in the business graveyard simply because they haven't adapted and haven't changed.
So, and that sort of points out to probably a lot of people that it's not just the products, it's the service. And I think a lot of people can forget that. They sort of think, I've got to hold everything and have that in stock, but it's how you get it to them and how they can order. It's all these things. But on the product note, how have products changed over the years?
Well, that's a really interesting one. So I think probably for the first, let's say, for example, we got very heavily involved in the sealant side of the business, probably in around about 2000, the year 2000. And what we've seen is not much change for a period of time. It's a fairly sort of, people have been using fairly similar products for a considerable period of time and still do to a large extent. So it's mainly your MECO products, so as the carrier, which is something that's been used for some time. So that hasn't really changed much. But what we are seeing more issues now around labelling and sort of risk management, if you like, of products. So by that, I mean, this is like EU legislation that we still pretty much follow around the chemicals within silicones that can be carcinogenic. Right. So awareness of that has improved over time. Again, more recently, and even today, we're still seeing that certain substances, which now are so MECO is a classic one, whereby as seen as being potentially carcinogenic, there's a move in the northern countries, so your Nordic countries, to start banning some of the products that you can still have within silicon, that will replace those completely, so that they have complete bans on certain chemicals. So that's one strand of how things are changing. So there's more awareness now about, you know, harmful products within sealants. And there are. We still see the. You still hear about people licking their fingers to tool off with, and then lick their finger again and use. You know, it's really not a good idea. So there's moves perhaps towards more alkoxes. We think over the next couple of 3 years, so that might change the way people use or change the actual formulations that people might use. I think the biggest change we're seeing, particularly post-COVID, is a move towards foil packs, so aluminium foil packs. And that's a really interesting and very close to my heart subject. I think we saw before COVID that people were starting to become more environmentally aware. You don't have to be a tree hugger, for want of a better phrase, to recognise that even if it's something that doesn't particularly float your boat, the environmental issues and net zero and so on and so forth, there is potential. Certain things are getting more expensive because government will eventually legislate against certain practices, certain materials. Often you get incentives, and then you get incentives with sticks, and then you end up with just sticks. You know, so it's normally through taxation. So I think COVID just stopped everything really in terms of real positive developments. I think certainly as an industry, certainly in our business, we all sort of put environmental and issues and those types of things to one side. And now I think we've got COVID in the rearview mirror firmly. Now I believe people are starting to think a bit more about the environmental impact of some of the products they use, or even the way they do business or live even. And so a classic example is where I feel we get somewhat myopic on these subjects is we had this big thing around single-use plastic straws. So this is, you know, you tend to think plastic straws, it's kids' drinks, you know, straws you put in pop or whatever it happens to be, and they're tiny. You know, if you think of a 310ml tube of silicon, the size of it, you could put scores of these tiny straws in there. And we had this big campaign for banning them, to ban the use. So it was on the BBC and whatever else for a few weeks, and we worried about the new laws and whatever else. And we all thought, great, you know, excellent. We've got this waste, you know, out of the system. But at the same time, we're all going to work and we're all using plastic cartridges on our sealants. And there's about 2 million of them a week end up in landfill because there's nothing else you can do with them. So every plastic cartridge that gets used literally will end up in a hole in the ground. And if you think about that compared to plastic straw use, I don't know the stats on plastic straws, but I do know that 2 million of empty cartridges, you know, I'm sure multiplies that figure, the waste from plastic straws, many, many, many times over. So we are at the forefront of doing something about that. One of the things that you asked me earlier about why do I like what I like about the window industry. Well, one of the things I do like about the window industry is it's been around for a long time, and it's likely to be around for a long time to come. And the downside to that is that sometimes people also get quite conservative in terms of what they use. So we've always used X, we've always used Y, and sometimes people don't want to change things, and that's fine. It's human nature. So we've taken it upon ourselves to highlight that there is an option that means you don't need to use a plastic cartridge. And there's not just the environmental benefit of doing so, but a wider benefit to people. Because, as we said earlier on, not everyone is particularly interested in climate or whatever aspect you want to focus in on of environmental issues. But most people are willing to, would like to save perhaps some money on there on what it costs them to buy various consumables. So, you know, for example, silicon. If you can buy silicon at a lower price, then you know it lowers your unit costs. It reduces your bills. Perhaps makes you more competitive in the marketplace. If you apply that to everything you do as a business, most people are interested in that. So, what we try to do is combine the two together. So, it doesn't matter what reason you want to use a foil or consider using a foil. There is a benefit to you, and so ultimately everybody wins. And we've done that with the what is called the saver foil from Siloxa. So it's called saver foil simply because it doesn't matter whether you want to save money, it doesn't matter whether you want to save the planet or save waste. You can do both, and they're mutually, you know, compatible.
Yeah, I like that.
That's a really good. It's a good combination. It's a win-win for everybody.
And then, like the fenestration world, it just takes a bit of time for them to adapt. But they do. You're seeing positive things.
Absolutely. So, with the customers we've got, we did some trial. We did some piloting. So we did originally a questionnaire with people: would they be interested in trying out a foil? To go completely against what I said about people being conservative, 8 out of 10 said they would be interested.
Wow.
If there was a cost saving. Okay, so that was very good. We brought the first foils in 4 or 5 months ago, and of the customers we've asked to take them, because the supply chain isn't really there at the moment. There's not with plastic cartridges, and I will come on to the supply chain aspect of that because it's a really interesting aspect. With the supply chain, there just isn't the sausages, if you like, on the shelves. That's another word for foils, is sausages, interchangeable word. So therefore, we can't, you know, if we just literally open the floodgates and say, right, here's the foils, we couldn't fulfill orders. So we'd be, you know, wouldn't be helping anybody. So it's a very much a slow process. But the take up has been very positive for those who've been offered the products. And I think without fail, there hasn't been a single customer who's tried foils who haven't reordered foils. Some of our customers are running two, both foils and cartridges, because some fitters don't want to use foils and have put their foot down and said that we're going to stick with cartridges. That's fine. But I think generally speaking, even where there's resistance, I think once you've actually used the foil and the misconceptions have been, you know, displaced, then people will, you know, there's a progression there that more and more people will see the benefits of them. Just to talk about the supply chain. So when we talk about waste here, with waste, when I go to a manufacturer and we work with 5 or 6 manufacturers, they will often show you you've got your finished goods warehouse for plastic cartridges, and they'll almost always have another warehouse, at least the same size, sometimes twice the size, that's just full of empty cartridges waiting to be filled. And if you think about it, if we are thinking about a typical manufacturer here, they probably have 5 or 6 grades of silicon that will go into the window industry, and an oxine typically. And those 5 or 6 products may well have their own branding, but they might have another 200, 300, 500 private labels. that they produce. So every private label will have to have its own batch of cartridges produced, and they need to be stored somewhere. But before they're stored somewhere, they need to be produced, which is the a problem. It's not just the disposal, it's the fact they're manufacturing plastic in the first place. And then they've got to be shipped. They have to be driven by lorry from the producing company to the where they're held, you know, in the warehouse for the manufacturer. And an interesting statistic is that if you take a 40-foot standard lorry trailer, if you fill that up and you can double stack pallets of empty plastic cartridges, it will take about 107,000 cartridges in that trailer. If you were to use the equivalent or the same amount of material that would go into those cartridges, but in foil packs instead, you could get over 4 million equivalent cartridges in that vehicle. Because the difference is the foil is actually, it comes in a coil, and it's actually only turned into a foil, a sausage, if you like, at the point of filling. So you've got coils in stock, but that coil could do 5,000 or 6,000 cartridges, or the equivalent of 5,000 or 6,000 cartridges. Yeah. So you can just see that the amount of waste. If you look at all the manufacturers of sealants, and you think about all of their grades and all of their, not just their own brand, but all of the private labels that they produce, and then you think about all those cartridges being produced in a factory, then transported, then stored, then filled, then ultimately discharged, and then thrown into a skip to end up in landfill. It makes the whole plastic straw thing seem quite trivial, but it's not something we talk about much. And I think that's just because it's just an awareness thing, really. Yeah.
Well, you've made a good start.
Thank you.
All the best on that journey. And I think it makes sense. It makes sense to me. So I think more and more people will jump on the bandwagon, I'm sure.
Yeah. And the other thing to bear in mind is that with a typical plastic cartridge, it's normally filled with between 280 and 310 millilitres of material. More often than not, it's 280 or 300. So it's not filled to its full capacity. I've seen it where it's been 260 mil filled, where you can put two things up the end of the tube and still struggle to find where the bung is in the bottom. With a foil pack, because it's literally just think of a sausage, really, just like your normal regular butcher's sausage. It's full, and therefore the actual physical size of a sausage is not much difference to a cartridge. But there's 400 millilitres of material in there. So you make a massive amount of difference. So there's the fact that you can do more, you can literally extrude more, so you can get more out of the sealant before you change it over. So again, that saves time and saves mess and so on and so forth. But it's the other side of it is when they actually dispose of it as well, because when the foil pack is actually extruded fully, it goes down into a tiny, tiny, so I'll wave it in front of you so you can see it. You. But that is an extruded foil pack. So it's gone from you know, a 310 mil foil, 310 mil plastic cartridge size, even though it's 400 mil in there, down to that. So you get around about at least 10, 9 or 10 of those. These
massive difference.
Yeah, exactly. Into a plastic cartridge. So it reduces your actual waste output. Forget about where it ends up. It actually reduces your output by about 90%. 90%.
And then they can be recycled or?
Yeah, so the next stage in the journey really is there's a couple of options. So at this very moment in time, they may well end up in landfill, but that's not the long-term or the shorter-term plan. They can be burnt into, depending on what material they've been used. So we're working with an industry body at the moment to determine what we can and can't put through into what they call waste as energy. So there's various plants, electricity generating plants, around the UK, and they can burn these materials, and they generate electricity with that, of course. And then they call it bottom ash. So what's left in the pan, if you like, of their fire can then be recycled back into materials such as aluminium. So they can actually reclaim the aluminium and then recycle that back into, and aluminium like carbon, for example, is highly recyclable. You can recycle it many times before it loses its properties. So the idea is what we're looking at eventually is once you've got some momentum behind this, we may even be able to take this product back, the finished foils back from our customers, and then we may well be able to palletize it up and send it on to to be either recycled or but certainly we're looking to get zero into landfill. That's fantastic. that's the objective.
Yeah, I like that.
Yes.
Well, that's quite a journey. It's probably about time for the questions. So in all of that journey, is there a low point that sticks out for you?
Low point. There's been a few, to be fair. I'm trying to think of what the one that's left its biggest mark on me is. We had the shortage of silicon, which was when
Don't envy that.
Effectively shut down the mines in China, where about 65-70% of the world's silica comes from, that goes into sealants. That was a very challenging time when we had people, our suppliers, phone us up and saying, get an order in. We haven't got any silicon. We don't know when we're getting any, and we don't know how much it's going to be. And we're ordering container loads of it, despite those facts, on the basis that what do our customers do if we don't have silicon? And we had that coming from 5-6 different suppliers just to make sure we had material on the shelf. That was the plan. That was a horrible period of time, because it was as what you'd like to think as a trusted partner with your customers. If you can't deliver to them what they need to do their job, their work, which then in turn they get paid for, that's quite a stress. We had the shipping crisis.
Didn't help.
Where a container went from, let's say, £1,500 from the Far East to £15,000. And again, you can't pass that on to your customers. You've got to absorb it. So again, that's stressful. I think low point wise, probably the lowest point is many years ago. We changed accountants, and we had a handover period that did not go well at all. And that was quite horrible to realise that our accounts needed to be looked at seriously. And you know, as the managing director, the buck stops with me, and I'm there to make sure that the business is running in a sound way for the benefits of the company, and also the benefits of the creditors ultimately in the bank. And when you realise that you've made a mistake, or somebody's made a mistake and you haven't spotted it, that makes you feel quite very humble, and failure is the wrong word, but it's a low point, because you know that it's your fault, and that's quite tough.
Well, on the flip side, is there a high point that sticks out for you?
I think the high point has been developing people and watching people develop. So what the flip side of when you feel you're a failure in business, or when things you should have done better and you didn't, and you can beat yourself up over it. On the other side, it does also give you an opportunity to help people of all ages. It's always very satisfying with younger people to see them grow in their roles, and not just in their roles, but as people. And there's many times when somebody's joined us as perhaps a slightly challenging individual, if you like. Perhaps it might be their first job, or early in their working career, and through sort of some hard work and some difficult times and some difficult words, people have moved on or have still stayed with us, who've actually learned something about life, working life, and their general work too, so their working life. So that's been really, really rewarding. And we're a very structured business, so we're extremely structured, we're very focused, and we're strategic in what we do. And again, that it almost goes back to what I was nearly going to do when I was leaving school. I was going to go to drama college, it's relatively creative type of field, if you like. And even though those types of things I just mentioned, as in strategic and structure and whatever else, sound fairly sort of analytical and the opposite of creative. Actually, you know, they're actually quite creative to produce, to put into place, and you know, to come up with them and actually realise. And I find that satisfies some of my creativity.
Yeah.
So that's a real positive. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah, I like that.
Yeah.
How many employees have you got?
So in total, we're about 15 employees.
Oh wow! Yeah. I think no one's expected.
Yeah.
I think most
yeah.
people would be surprised.
Yeah, absolutely. And as I say, it's a family business. We see family, you know, the whole concept of family to me is wider than just blood.
Yeah.
You know, it's a case we look out for each other. We try and develop people. We try and help people through difficult times. It's the traditional family sorts of things that family do without necessarily the blood. But we do have blood too in the business. So
yeah.
Jenny Reed is my wife. She's been with the business. This is where I'm going to embarrass myself now. It's a long time. I can't exactly remember when. It seems like forever. And I mean that in a nice way. But after we had kids, then she had a career at the University of Cambridge. And she chucked that in to be with the children. Then obviously did more and more with work with Wizzle or UK Fixings as we were at the time. And she's marketing director. So that's a big passion of hers is marketing. So she's played a real massive role in how things have progressed. And we also have David too. So Dave Reed is my son. He's the one I go cycling with. He's my youngest son. He spent 5 years in an accountancy practice.
Right.
He joined the business about 18 months ago, and he became a director last week of the business. So it's really, really quite nice. The only thing I don't like about it sometimes is having that sort of close family dynamic, is that it's the old Friday evening thing, yeah. Saturday afternoon thing, Sunday lunchtime. It always ends up on work conversation-wise.
Yeah.
And of course, it's bad enough for just me and Jenny, but with Dave there as well now, there's I've never seemed to get away from the grip of, you know, conversation around work. But it wouldn't change anything. It's really good. So as a company, we have the 15, got the family, but we are, you know, we've got Neil, obviously, who's been there for 30 odd years, and our sales team too. We've got Dave and Dave Robertson and Darren, and they've been again with the company for I think 10 plus years. So we've got a lot of long service there.
Yeah, a lot of experience as well. Yeah, I like that. Last question. If you were to spend 2 weeks on a desert island with someone from within the fenestration industry, who would it be?
Well, I have to be careful what I say, but I would 100% say Jenny Reed from Wizzle, because she's great at marketing and she's my wife and I love her dearly.
Good answer. Very good answer.
Thank you.
Yeah, no, thank you. Mark, thank you very much for your time today. You're welcome back anytime. All the best for your journey, and hopefully all works well with the saver foil, and keep us up to date. Welcome
thank
back
you very
anytime.
Much. Yes, my pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. That was a great conversation with Mark. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. If you'd like to hear more conversations like this one, consider subscribing. Otherwise, thank you for listening. Until next time.